Friends and family out there, thank you so much for listening. This is the First United Methodist Church of Round Rock, Texas podcast. One thing that we're doing coming up in this next string of podcasts, these next seasons that we have, is we're featuring some of our community, some of our people here and what makes our community special. We have so many amazing people, but this one in particular, I wanted to get on as kind of a starter. Just to hold the bar, Tom Lowe is going to hold the bar real high. I met Tom in our rehearsals, in our Sunday morning rehearsals. This guy used to come in. He had his Egg McMuffin. He had, it's okay to laugh in the mic. Tom's cracking up. He had his Egg McMuffin and he had a little notepad and he was just writing down what we were doing. And I remember looking over to Brian and looking over to some other people. I said, who in the world is this dude? That and he would come up and ask really interesting questions. And I was like, yeah, okay, sure. Thanks, man. And then got to know Tom, got to know a little bit more of Tom's story. Here's some of his compositions, which we're going to get into. What an amazing, fascinating human being. This is just going to be so cool. I'm really excited. Tom, thanks for joining.
Okay, glad to be here.
Yeah, yeah. So, Tom, you've been a member of the church for how long now at FUMC Round Rock?
Well, we moved here in November of 2014 and became instant members as soon as we landed.
What drew you guys here to FUMC Round Rock?
Well, we knew about the church ahead of time. We used to live in Kentucky, in western part of Kentucky, and I had some dealings with the University of Texas around 2010, 2011, and we came down to do a little bit of research associated with some of my Olympic work from back in 1968. Over the weekend, I said, well, let's go to church on Sunday. Okay, well, let's Google and see if they got Methodist churches around here. Of course they do. Oh, here's one in Round Rock. Looks like it has a pretty good choir and everything. Okay. So we ended up going, and the first sign was that the visitor parking lot was full, and the rest of the parking lot was full. And so after we finally got a parking spot, which is always a good problem for a church to have, we didn't get in until the first hymn was going. The first thing we noticed, a congregation that sings. Oh, all right. And then a full choir, an organ blaring, orchestra going, handbells going, turned to Posey, and she gave a fist pump. All right, or something like that. And it just felt like, oh, my golly, this is a great church. It's going to be a great experience. And music has always been an extremely important part of our spiritual life. And we were extremely both impressed and blessed by being at the church that day. And I guess we had been to the church maybe five or six times. And then we started seeing at the university where I was teaching, it's time to retire. Well, where are we going to go? So a long time ago, I had been stationed in Texas in the Army, and I'd always wanted to go back to Texas, and this seemed like to be the perfect opportunity to do that. So we ended up coming to Round Rock. Didn't know a soul here, but we just landed and had the church as our target.
I love that. I love that. So let's do this, because you've had such an incredible life, such an interesting life. You were a military man that graduated from West Point, second lieutenant, Corps of Engineers, Vietnam, Korea, Olympics. You're a composer. You've done massive work with the university. I mean, like I told you earlier when we were talking, I said, I'm going to turn in my man card.
No.
I'm just going to turn it over, and it's just unbelievable. The life you've had, the sacrifices you've made for the generation that I have and the generations to come. Let's start in the beginning of Tom Lowe's life. Let's give the listeners a little preview here of how you got here, of what happened. So where did you grow up?
Well, I grew up in the Shenandoah Valley of Virginia in a little town called Elkton. And part of the time I was growing up, about 5 years of that time, was right on the banks of the Shenandoah River, which was an amazing experience.
Sort of
like Huckleberry Finn type of thing.
Yeah.
And It was just a wonderful experience. Got to go to a great high school. And as I was going through the high school, I became interested in West Point and started reading Dwight David Eisenhower's biography about his life at West Point and how he went on to become an officer in the Army. And our family didn't have any money for college tuition anyway, so that seemed like a good way to think about going to college, where you have a full scholarship, essentially. And just as a backup, I sent $20 to Virginia Polytechnic Institute to hold a spot for me in aeronautical engineering if I didn't make it to West Point. But as things happened, the stars aligned, and I was able to get in as a qualified alternate for one or two of the slots that were unfilled by other qualified people. So I took a train ride up in July of 1960. But let me tell you a little bit about how the stars were already aligning for that, because we didn't have any money to put toward it.
But let me ask you, did you grow up in a family, a church-going family?
Yeah, my dad was the 10th of 10 children, and his dad was a Methodist minister in North Carolina Circuit. And my dad was a supervisor at a chemical plant, and it was a very blue-collar job, and we had enough money to live, but not enough to, you know, pay my way to college or anything. So when I graduated from high school, I was able to win a $350 scholarship in form of a check. And I thought, wow, this is some real money there. And then about 3 weeks later, the telegram came from West Point, and they said, well, for your initial deposit, we're going to require a check of $300. Ooh, I've got that.
Yeah.
And so I paid that. And then the transportation up to West Point, I had to take a train from Elkton to New York City, which cost $38. And then I had to take a bus up to Highland Falls, which is next door to West Point, which cost about $8. Then I had to spend some money on the boarding house for the night before we go in, and then breakfast. I was out of money when I walked through the gates, but I had just enough to get there. It was amazing.
Wow. That's incredible. And how long did you go to school there at West Point?
Yeah, it was a full four-year curriculum.
Okay.
The first 2 months in the summer is what's called Beast Barracks, where you have to undergo a lot of orientation, a lot of basic Army training and basic West Point training. And then in September, you join the rest of the Corps of Cadets, and it becomes essentially an academic environment with a lot of military responsibilities. And then each summer in between the academic years, there's training or trips to various military bases or other opportunities like that. So that by the time I graduated in June of 1964, I had a fairly good engineering background for academics, and then I had a fairly good overview of the Army in terms of military bases and doctrine and all that sort of thing.
And so you went directly to the Corps of Engineers after West Point.
Yeah, we had to select a branch that we wanted to serve in before we graduated. And the Corps of Engineers was my choice because, well, I can apply my engineering background to that and really enjoy that. But most of the class, when they graduated, went on to Army training. But when I was at West Point, I had a chance to be in the triathlon club, which was a combination club of running, swimming, and pistol shooting. And I wasn't really a good athlete there for any individual sport, but I was a fairly good athlete as far as combinations of sports go. And I found out about this Olympic sport called modern pentathlon that included the triathlon plus fencing plus horseback riding. And again, luck was on my side because while I was at West Point, they restarted the fencing program there so I could learn how to fence. And I spent, I represented West Point 2 years in the NCAA National Championships in fencing.
Wow.
So that was kind of fun to be able to do that. Well, it turns out that when I graduated, someone at the Department of Army Sports said, this person may have Olympic potential. Let's send him down to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, for evaluation. So instead of going to military school right off the bat, my first duty assignment was actually at Fort Sam Houston, where the National Training Center for Modern Pentathlon was. So for 6 months, I went through all the training for the five different sports and got evaluated. And they said, well, it looks like you may have Olympic potential, or at least for the trials in 1968. So you have to satisfy your Army career responsibilities. So if you'll agree to the following schedule for assignments, we'll make some arrangements for you. So they wanted to send me to Airborne and Ranger School, and then to Korea for a troop assignment, and then to Fort Sam Houston for training, Olympic training, and then after that to Vietnam. And if I would agree to that, then they would make it happen.
Wow. Okay, so let's go chronologically. So okay. I'm just blown away.
Well, it was quite an amazing sequence that they had put together for me.
I mean, my goodness, and all in such a short amount of time.
Oh, yeah.
Like a couple years here, a couple years here. Man, you graduate West Point, and then you're going overseas to serve, and then you're doing the Olympics, and it's just incredible. So let me ask, what was the first in line? Was it Korea? Was it Vietnam? Was it the Olympics?
Yeah, well, the first military assignment was actually Ranger and Airborne School in January of 65. So I had to finish those. And then I was shipped off to Korea for the 7th Infantry Division, where I served as a platoon leader in the Combat Engineer Battalion. And there we did a lot of construction work with roads and bridges and building bunkers and so forth. Korea was very different then than it is today. There was probably only one paved road in the entire country.
Wow.
And they had no infrastructure. There was nothing on the hills. When it rained, the water ran off and washed all the roads and bridges out. And we had to help them restore all that. But it was a very exciting time to be there. And while I was there, I worked with our battalion chapel as the organist, and then they hired some Korean music students from Seoul to come up every Sunday morning to be our choir. So I got to interact with them and direct them. And, here's this lieutenant who knows nothing about music directing these graduate students from these institutions or universities in Seoul.
Yeah.
But it was just a wonderful experience. And I think that's where I first put my pen to paper to write out a little choral response or an amen or something. And that kind of started me on the road to music composition for churches.
Wow. So that's so Korea was the beginning of Tom Lowe, the composer.
Well, yeah, I think, I found some notes that I had written out from that when we were going through some of our boxes not too long ago. But anyway, during that time, I also had another musical experience. As a extra assignment, they asked me to write a history of their Combat Engineer Battalion. And so I wrote that up and sent it in, and apparently it got some pretty high marks because I got a letter of commendation back from the 8th Army historian congratulating me on the quality of the work, and also a bonus that in gratitude, they would assign me as the escort officer to a USO show. So for 2 weeks, I got to escort Johnny Mathis and his singing group and orchestra around Korea as he went to perform at various Air Force and Army bases.
Man, how cool is that? We didn't talk about that. How cool is that?
Yeah, and I'm still in touch with several of the singers and dancers from that group today. And it was just a marvelous time, and really enjoyed that.
For you youngsters out there, if you don't know Johnny Mathis, well, first of all, if you don't know Tom Lowe.
No.
But second of all, if you don't know Johnny Mathis, y'all, we need to get on Spotify and iTunes and get some Johnny Mathis in your life.
That's right, yeah.
Amen.
And he's still singing. So,
and so that you were in Korea from when? How many years there?
Well, from March 65. To June of 66, more or less.
Man, so you graduate West Point 64.
Mm.
You do very small training in San Antonio.
Mm-hmm.
And you're going straight to Korea. So this is in a matter of like a year.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So then I arrive in San Antonio in the summer of 66.
Okay, so we're back in San Antonio, summer of 66. So you were in Korea for a year.
Yeah, it was okay. Longer than a year. It's closer to 12, 15, 15, 16, 18 months maybe.
Okay.
Something like that, 16 to 18 months. But anyway, when I came back, I got assigned to Fort Sam Houston Garrison, and that gave me enough time to participate at the National Training Center for Modern Pentathlon. I didn't measure up in any of the sports particularly, but I was a fairly good runner, but I was able to improve fairly quickly in all the sports except swimming. I was a horrible swimmer. I was on the rock squad and had to have double workouts in swimming each day. It was just awful. Wow.
I got to tell the listeners out there, Tom, how old are you now?
I'm 81.
81 years old. Our stage at church is like waist high. Oh. Maybe a little more than waist high.
Oh, you got to tell that.
And one of the first times I met Tom, he came up to the stage to talk to us, and he couldn't find the stairs. And if I'm lying, I'm dying, man. The guy just bounced up on stage. I looked around. I was like, there's no way I could do that ever. Like, not at any age. And you got Tom in his 80s. Hopping, you know, the guy's got like a 3-foot vertical hopping up and down the stairs. Tom is still an athlete. So this is so fascinating about the Olympics. Let's dive into that. So wait, I'm getting ahead of myself here because okay. I'm getting excited. So was it Vietnam first and then the Olympics or Olympics, Vietnam?
The Olympics and then Vietnam.
Okay, yeah, let's go. Let's go Olympics. Let's dive in.
Yeah. So after about a year, year and a half of training, I got to where I was bubbling up to maybe the top 8 or 10 at the training center. And in 1967, I finished high enough in the national championships that I got qualified to go to the International Military Championships in Bordeaux, France. So that was my first international experience in modern pentathlon, and that was like a sort of a rehearsal for the Olympics the next year. And based on that, I got selected to go to Mexico City in 1967 for what they called the Little Olympics. This is a special competition they had for the judges and the administration staff of the Olympics so that athletes could come there and compete, but the judges and the administrators could practice what it's like to have a high-level competition at their venue.
Wow.
Just for scoring purposes, I'll mention that our team won the bronze medal for the Little Olympics in modern pentathlon, and we beat the French team by about 10 or 12 points. So let's keep that in mind when I tell you the story about what happened when the real Olympics came.
Okay, okay. And so you're there in Mexico. You do what they call the Little Olympics. Mm. You come back to San Antonio, or you stay?
I come back another year of training. And then here we are in May of 68, the Olympic trials are coming up, and I'm fencing in the national championships in Miami. And all of a sudden, I feel a pain in my leg. I had injured my leg in fencing. I had a severe muscle separation of my quadricep muscle. And the pain was so bad, they had to pull me out of competition, and then they brought me back to San Antonio, and I was in the hospital for about 5 weeks or so with my leg in traction. And here we are about 2 months before the Olympic trials, and I'd been working for 2 years for that. So in the hospital bed, I recognize, you know, I've got to make a choice here. Do I just kind of give up, or do I take charge and really turn this thing around? Well, it turned out that in that same hospital ward were wounded helicopter pilots from Vietnam. And when they found out that I was an athlete in training, they started yelling at me to, you know, get busy. You can work out here. You can, you know, they gave me all kinds of encouragement and tough love and everything. And it was then that I sort of explored a new level of depth for my spiritual faith. I brought had my friends bring my Bible. I had them bring the devotional book and the Heart of a Champion by Bob Richards, and realized that, you know, I can do workouts here in my hospital bed. It was like I felt like a spiritual wave. The Lord was telling me, look, don't worry, this is going to work out, but you got to do your part. So, for example, for riding, I took my crutch apart and used the bottom piece of it. I put that in between my knees and would squeeze that sideways to keep my holding on muscles strong for the horse.
So you took your crutches.
Yeah.
Took them apart.
Yeah.
And basically
use that bottom piece. That
basically bottom piece, made my Suzanne
horse.
Summers thigh master.
Well, I don't know. But one of my friends brought my fencing sword and a golf ball and a piece of string. And so they hung the golf ball from the traction frame. And I could sit in the bed and practice poking at the swinging golf ball with my fencing sword.
It's just a different breed of person.
It's an attitude. You got to take charge. And
okay. So I want to get in on this. So there's a spiritual aspect of this where you're feeling God just lifting you up, going, it's cool, I got it. Just keep doing your thing. But then talk more about the attitude behind it. What does it take in those kind of moments? Like, what kind of inspiration in those moments? What kind of
It's
mindset in those moments?
You know, you hear about the still small voice, and many times in my life I've felt impelled to do something, and I don't understand why, but I know it's something I should do, I must do, and I do. And this was that sort of thing. I could not work out in my hospital bed. I just had to do it. And so I've got the fencing, I've covered the riding. And I want to tell about the shooting and the swimming. Couldn't do running because my leg was up in the air in traction, so I had to let that go. But my nurse rigged a pulley above my head on the traction frame so I could keep my arms limber like that. And then in the traction bag that was pulling on my leg, there were lead weights about 4 inches in diameter that must have weighed about, 10 pounds each maybe. So I would grab one of those lead weights and hold that out to my side and pretend it was my pistol and raise and lower it and hold it steady so I could keep my pistol arm strong and steady like that. So over the weeks I was in the hospital, several of my training buddies came up to visit me and give me encouragement, which I really appreciated. But the upshot is that when I left the hospital with about 6 weeks before the Olympic trials, I came out not as a person sort of tired and defeated. I came out as a person ready to go, had this let's get going with attitude. And I got back into workouts very carefully into the running. When the Olympic trials came, they said, well, this year we're going to do them differently. We're going to do double trials back to back. But this has never been done before, so we had to do a trial in all five events, and then another trial in all five events right afterwards. That's going to make sure that you're consistent, and it's also going to make sure that you have enough strength and endurance to carry on the whole thing.
Yeah, and this is just your ticket in.
Yeah, this is to make the team, but we found out later, not quite, but I'll tell you about that in a minute. So anyway, the Olympic trials start, and I just had this feeling the whole time that I was just being pulled along, tugged along by this still small voice, and I feel the power of the Spirit telling me, look, just do your best, just focus, it's going to be okay, I got this. And throughout the trials, the risky parts are drawing a strange horse and riding it, and I did well in both of those. And then the second most risky is fencing, because that's very iffy whether you have a good day or a bad day. And I had two really good days in the fencing.
So you didn't get to choose your horse. You just...
Oh, no, it's a strange horse. It's supposed to be a test of the rider, not of the horse. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's over jumps, cross-country jumps. Well, just so you know how special these horses are, here we are, 50, 60 years afterwards. And when we get together with other pentathlon athletes of years gone by, we've made a list of all the horses that we trained on. And then we tell stories about what happened to us on these horses. And and it's just horrendous accidents and all these other things. But those are the stories that, carry forward.
So
it
you
has
still,
the spirit of the sport.
But wait, so you have a group, like a community of people that competed that you guys get together?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a lot of the people after they trained in San Antonio and left the Army, they just stayed there. So there's a group of, you know, 30 or 40 that live in the Texas area, Central Texas area. We have a email distribution list, and then once every 5 or 10 years, they'll have a get together. It's not very frequent, but we stay connected.
Man, I'd love to be a fly on the wall in some of those conversations. Some of the stories,
yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. But I wanted to tell you what happened after the Olympic trials. I finished in second place, which was astounding. Well, this year they said, well, since the Olympics are in Mexico City with a high altitude, we have to make sure that you can handle the high altitude. So we're going to say that the top six are selected for the final trial in Colorado. Okay, so they shipped us out to Colorado Springs. And then the first thing they did was to send us up to Pikes Peak to spend some days up there getting acclimated to really thin air. Well, I managed to stay in second place, which was good, and we formed our team of three with one alternate, and we're selected and outfitted and off to Mexico City in October for the Olympics. It was an amazing experience.
Incredible. Incredible. So here you are. How old are you at this point? 68?
26, yeah.
26 years old, yeah. 68. We've already done West Point tour in Korea, Army Corps of Engineers. At this point, are you second lieutenant?
By this time, I've been promoted first lieutenant and then to captain. So I'm a captain by the time I get to...
Captain in the Army Corps of Engineers going to Mexico City 68 to do a pentathlon.
Yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, I've played guitar.
Pretty well.
For a couple of years, and I like to cook, and this is what I'm saying. It's a whole nother breed of person. This is just so amazing.
Well, I think I had the opportunities and was able to take advantage of that, and I really want to make sure that our listeners know you never know what can happen until you try, and I had no idea what would happen until I tried.
That's it.
Go to West Point. Had no idea what would happen to try making the Olympic team, and that continues today.
Thank you so much for listening to part one on the life of Tom Lowe. There's so much more to come. He's had such an incredible life. Still to come, we have his actual time in the Olympics, Vietnam, his experience with the 1972 Olympics in Munich with the Israeli hostage situation, as well as being an engineer for Lego, a well-credited and well-respected established composer. There's so much more to come. As always, we very much so thank you for tuning in. Please remember to like and subscribe, as well share this with your friends and family. We hope you keep tuning in as we have so much more to come in the new year. And as always, God bless you, stay safe, love each other well, and we hope to see you soon at the First United Methodist Church of Round Rock, Texas.